Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
July 27th will mark the 70th anniversary of the armistice in which North Korean and American military commanders signed to halt fighting the 3 years of war and promised to return within 90 days to negotiate a peace settlement. Well, that hasn't happened yet.
As the U.S. sends a nuclear-armed submarine to South Korea for the first time since the 1980s, peace activists are gathering in Washington, D.C. to call on President Biden and Congress to officially end the Korean War. We'll speak to Christine Ahn of Women Cross DMZ and historian Bruce Cummings. Then to the assassination of Malcolm X, an eyewitness to Malcolm's shooting reveals for the first time he overheard a New York police officer ask about Malcolm's assassin, is he with us? We'll hear Mustafa Hassan describe what he saw and heard February 21st, 1965 in the Audubon Ballroom and talk about why he was never called to testify.
The reason that they failed to call me would have been that my testimony would have changed the outcome of the trial.
They got some more questions.
It would have pointed a finger of guilt at the establishment.
We'll speak to civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who's representing Malcolm X's family. We're planning to file a $100 million wrongful death lawsuit against the FBI, the CIA, New York City and State, and the NYPD, as well as the district attorney's office for concealing evidence of their involvement in the assassination. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A new study published in Nature Communications finds Atlantic Ocean currents could collapse as soon as 2025 due to climate change, triggering catastrophic conditions around the globe. What's known as the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation carries warm water from the tropics to the North Atlantic and sends colder water south along the ocean floor. The warming planet's expected to push this phenomenon over a tipping point as fresh water from melting Arctic ice disrupts and weakens the current. This could set in motion rapid and disastrous changes to the climate, including disrupting rains that feed crops for billions of people across South Asia, Latin America, and West Africa, a drop in temperatures in Northern Europe, higher temperatures in the tropics, and faster sea level rise along the coasts of North America and Europe. It also further threatens the Amazon and Antarctic ice sheets. This comes as water temperatures in Florida soar past 100 degrees in the ocean, triggering signs of mass coral bleaching and die-off. The water in the Florida Keys hit a world record high of 101.1 degrees Fahrenheit this week. In immigration news, a federal judge in California has blocked the Biden administration from enforcing a measure prohibiting migrants from seeking asylum at the southern border without first applying for protection in a country they passed through on their journey to the United States. But U.S. District Judge John Tiger has delayed his ruling for 14 days, keeping the policy in place while giving Biden officials time to file an appeal. Tiger's decision was praised by immigration rights advocates, who've condemned President Biden for supporting asylum bans similar to those enacted by President Trump. The new asylum rules went into effect in May, replacing the contested pandemic-era Title 42 policy, which was used to expel nearly 3 million asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border without due process. Biden's measure also forces migrants to make their asylum appointments on a Customs and Border Protection smartphone app that applicants say is riddled with issues and raises serious concerns over privacy. The ACLU said, quote, "The ruling is a victory, but each day the Biden administration prolongs the fight over its illegal ban, many people fleeing persecution and seeking safe harbor for their families are instead left in grave danger. In Ukraine, former U.S. Marine Trevor Reed, who was freed from Russian imprisonment in a prisoner swap last year, was reportedly injured while fighting in Ukraine and transferred to Germany for treatment. The Biden administration clarified Reed was, quote, not engaged in any activities on behalf of the U.S. government, unquote. Amidst concerns, the news could jeopardize any ongoing or future negotiations to release other U.S. citizens imprisoned in Russia. Meanwhile, Russian media reports the prominent sociologist and dissident Boris Kagolitsky was detained and is being charged with calling for terrorism. The charges could land him in prison for up to 7 years, according to his lawyer. Kagolitsky appeared on Democracy Now! Last December.
Russia is losing the war, and Russia is going to lose the war inevitably. So this is a very dramatic news for the Russian public. But now it is what is happening is that Russian public is beginning to understand this reality.
In related news, Russian lawmakers approved legislation Tuesday that would increase the upper age limit for military conscription from 27 to 30 and ban drafted Russians from leaving the country. In Yemen, the United Nations has begun pumping over 1 million barrels of oil from a decaying supertanker anchored in the Red Sea. The ship was abandoned off the coast of Yemen in 2015 at the start of the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war against Houthi rebels. Experts warned of a potentially catastrophic oil spill due to the ship's corrosion and lack of maintenance. This is U.N. Humanitarian Coordinator David Gressley.
We do expect that this will take approximately 19 days to move the 1.1 million barrels off of the vessel. Primary security threats have been fully mitigated in this case. The primary issue, of course, is that this is a country still at war, civil war, but also within the region. And that causes a great deal of distrust and a lot of more scrutiny from a security point of view.
In Tunisia, hundreds of protesters rallied in Tunis Tuesday to mark the 2 years since President Kais Saied dissolved parliament, ramped up his power grab in what many have called a coup. Protesters are also demanding he release 20 imprisoned opposition figures. This is Lajmi Larimi of the opposition Salvation Front Party.
The situation now is a state of frustration and despair among the citizens generally. This is the result of Kais Saied seizing power with an iron fist, consolidating all authorities in one hand. The unfortunate reality is that demolishing democracy does not foster development or stability.
In Cambodia, Prime Minister Hun Sen announced he'll step down in 3 weeks and transfer power to his oldest son, Hun Manet. The widely expected move comes just days after Hun Sen won re-election in a race where he ran virtually unopposed after suppressing the only viable challenger. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's BJP is facing a no-confidence vote in parliament in a bid by opposition parties to force Modi to address the escalating violence in the northeastern state of Manipur. Modi is not at risk of losing the vote, as the BJP and allies hold a clear majority. But anger has been mounting over the Hindu nationalist leader's inaction, as more than 130 people have been killed and 60,000 displaced since ethnic violence between the majority Meitei and minority Kuki communities broke out in May. Last week, a video of two Kuki women being paraded naked and assaulted by a mob triggered widespread outrage and protests.
It's an attack against all vulnerable women of this country. India is supposed to be the fraternity. India is supposed to be the plurality. India is supposed to be the more vibrant and acceptance in its culture and tradition. The whole world, women have bowed their heads and condemning this. This is highly unacceptable.
A new report by an international panel details the involvement of Mexican armed forces in the 2014 disappearance of 43 students from Ayotzinapa. The interdisciplinary group of independent experts said in its findings that the Mexican Army, Navy, police and intelligence agencies knew the students' whereabouts, including the night they were ambushed by local police and federal military forces and disappeared. The panel has also accused Mexican government officials under the previous administration of lying in their initial investigation, hiding key evidence and using torture to obtain false testimonies in the case. This is a member of the international panel speaking Tuesday.
The site of the study, the streets that we have seen before of Iguala on September 26th and 27th, showed that government forces were present. They participated and did not protect. They also know and knew what happened. The concealment of that information has contributed not only to the concealing of government responsibilities, but it has constituted in itself a responsibility of the state in the disappearance of these young men.
Back in the United States, Northwestern University is in the midst of a growing scandal over abusive hazing practices in athletic departments. On Monday, a volleyball player sued Northwestern over alleged retaliation after she reported abuse. This follows lawsuits by former Northwestern quarterback Lloyd Yates, who spoke out at a news conference in Chicago last week.
There was a code of silence that felt insurmountable to break. And speaking up could lead to consequences that affected playing time and can warrant further abuse. Normalizing this culture became a necessity. The abusive hazing was so entrenched in the Northwestern football culture that even some of our coaches took part in it. The graphic, sexually intense behavior was well known throughout the program. We were physically and emotionally beaten down, and some players have contemplated suicide as a result. The abusive culture was especially devastating for many players of color.
Northwestern's head football coach, Pat Fitzgerald, has been fired in the wake of the sexual hazing revelations. Attorney Ben Crump says Northwestern's athletic departments normalized a pattern and practice of physical and mental abuse and that some of the students were minors when the abuse took place. We'll speak to Ben Crump about this and other stories later in the broadcast. UPS workers reached a historic tentative deal on a new contract, averting what would have been a highly disruptive strike at the end of the month. The Teamsters Union said the deal, affecting some 340,000 members, includes higher wages for all workers, creates more full-time jobs, guarantees air conditioning in vehicles, among other health and safety measures. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Virginia Congressmember Bobby Scott introduced the Raise the Wage Act of 2023 Tuesday, which would increase the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $17 an hour by 2028. The minimum wage was last raised 14 years ago. Sanders called $7.25 a starvation wage, adding, quote, "In the year 2023, a job should lift you out of poverty, not keep you in it." Texas Congressmember Greg Kassar held an eight-hour thirst strike on Tuesday on the steps of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., to highlight the need for a federal workplace heat standard, which includes mandatory water breaks for workers. Over the course of the hot and humid day, where temperatures reached the high 80s in D.C., elected officials, advocates, and workers spoke in support of legislation demanding heat protections. This is Fernando Arista, an electrical worker from Austin, speaking out against a recently passed Texas law banning water breaks.
Proponents of this bill, they talk about business. They say it'll help out business and it'll help out the Texas economy. Well, we workers are part of the Texas economy. And if it'll help out businesses, it'll help out businesses at the exploitation of workers.
Up to 2,000 workers in the U.S. die every year from heat exposure. In related news, Texas prisons recently raised the cost of bottled water sold in commissaries by 50% as incarcerated people endure an unrelenting heat wave without air conditioning. Prisoners say they have to buy water because the tap is unsafe, with one person likening it to sewage water. And Juan Ramos, former Philadelphia City Council member, founder and leader of the Philadelphia chapter of the Young Lords, has died at the age of 71 after a battle with Alzheimer's. Ramos was just two when his family moved from Puerto Rico to Philadelphia, became active in civil rights in high school. He spoke out against racism, police brutality, as well as poverty and housing issues in communities of color. Ramos later helped lead efforts in the Puerto Rican community to defeat Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo's attempt to eliminate term limits. He went on to found and lead the Puerto Rican Alliance, which fought for bilingual education against police brutality and spearheaded a large squatters movement in abandoned government-owned houses. This led to over 150 Puerto Rican families eventually winning titles to those homes. He also served as a Philadelphia council member, a union organizer, and a church deacon. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, the U.S. sends a nuclear-armed submarine to South Korea for the first time since the 1980s. Stay with us. Chris Bruce. The song was written for this week's national mobilization to end the Korean War. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, tensions are escalating again on the Korean Peninsula. The United States has deployed a nuclear-armed submarine, the USS Kentucky, to South Korea for the first time since the 80s. Last week, South Korea's president, Yoon Suk-yeol, became the first foreign leader to ever board a U.S. nuclear-armed submarine. Meanwhile, on Monday, North Korea fired two ballistic missiles into the sea to protest the U.S. On Monday, North Korea fired those missiles into the sea hours after another U.S. submarine, the nuclear-propelled USS Annapolis, arrived at a port on Jeju Island. This all comes 70 years after the signing of the Korean Armistice, which was signed July 27, 1953. While the agreement halted active fighting in the Korean War, a peace agreement was never signed. This week, peace activists are gathering in Washington, D.C. for a national mobilization to call on President Biden and Congress to officially end the Korean War and replace the armistice with a peace agreement. We're joined now by two guests. Bruce Cummings is a professor of history at University of Chicago, author of several books on Korea, including Korea's Place in the Sun, A Modern History, and North Korea, Another Country. But first, we go to Christine Ahn, founder and executive director of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War, also the coordinator of the campaign Korea Peace Now. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Christine, talk about the significance of this week, of this date, and what exactly you're calling for in Washington, D.C., before you head off to the State Department after this interview.
Thank you so much, Amy and Juan, for having us. It is so significant that hundreds of people from across the country, multi-generational Korean Americans, many from divided families, humanitarian aid workers with on-the-ground experience in North Korea, academics. We have a conference with nuclear scientists Siegfried Hecker, Bruce Cummings, Dan Leaf, who is a three-star general, who wrote in a New York Times op-ed that it's time to end the Korean War and make peace with North Korea. So it is a phenomenal gathering of a broad and diverse coalition, many longstanding Korean-American organizations that have been working for peace, but also on social and economic justice, all coming together. And so we will be having a congressional press conference tomorrow. It's actually hosted by Barbara Lee, who you may know was the only member of Congress to vote against giving Bush authorization to use force in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that was because of her father, who served in the Korean War. And in the moments before she had to make that decision, he told her there is nothing that good that comes from war. And so that is what the incentive for her to take that bold and brave stance. So we're having a press conference. We're having a Han and Healing Circle with renowned dancer Dohee Lee and Joseph Han, who won numerous rewards for his book called Nuclear Family. And then we have a White House rally that begins at 5 p.m. with renowned social media star Nick Cho, your Korean dad, Josephine Lee, and actually David Kim, who ran for Congress in Koreatown, is running again. He'll be also speaking at the White House. And then on Friday, we have a conference at George Washington University. And many folks can join virtually. You just go to the KoreaPeaceAction.org, and there's a schedule there. But we really would love hundreds, thousands of people to gather with us. We'll march from the White House and towards the Korean War Memorial, where we will honor all the lives that have been killed, not just the 36,000 U.S. soldiers, but the over 2 million, mostly Korean civilians. And, you know, we're going to be carrying photos, portraits of the people that we've lost, our ancestors, because 70 years is just far too long. And as the situation grows more and more dangerous and tense, this has to end. And this is not just a war between North and South Korea. This is America's oldest war. And we, the people in the United States, have our responsibility to pressure our government to do the right thing and end this war.
And Christine, most of the people listening or seeing, viewing this show were not even born when the Korean War erupted. Could you talk about how it began and why we still have about 28,000 troops, American troops stationed in South Korea?
Well, the Korean Peninsula, my parents were actually born in the 1920s during Japanese occupation. And so from 1910 to 1945, Korea was colonized by the Japanese. And at the end of World War II, in the defeat of Japan, the Soviets and the Americans were scrambling, right? And so the Korean Peninsula was a place where actually the front line of the Cold War. And so it was actually two U.S. Young defense officials who were assigned to basically divide up the peninsula. And Charles Bonesteel and Dean Rusk, later Secretary of State, tore a page from the National Geographic and literally drew a line across the 38th parallel, giving north of it to the Soviets and the U.S. keeping south of it and Seoul. And that was Truman, who then sent a memo to Stalin, and Stalin accepted. But really, I would say that it's the U.S. that, you know, divided the peninsula. And we held military governments in South Korea from 1945 to 1948. And then, you know, Kim Il-sung emerged as the leader in the North. And then the U.S. installed Syngman Rhee to be the president of South Korea. And then in that period, this is where Bruce is really helpful. He has shown that there, you know, most of the official narrative is that the Korean War began on June 25th, 1950, when the North Koreans crossed over into South Korea, crossed the 38th parallel. Well, in fact, what Bruce and other historians have found is that there were incursions back and forth, actually, for a long period of time. But it was at that moment that when the North Koreans crossed into South Korea that the United States, under President Truman, basically called for not authorization to go to war, but a limited police action, went to the Security Council, got overwhelming votes in support of the U.S. intervening under what is called a U.N. command. And it is not a United Nations command, as it the ruse is. It is actually a unified command. And but they still use the U.N. flag, and that what is basically the beginning of the Korean War.
I want to turn to a clip from the documentary Crossings, which is now streaming on PBS World Channel. This is Ri Oki testifying at the Women's Peace Symposium in Pyongyang about her experience surviving being fired at by U.S. soldiers during the Korean War.
The bullet mercilessly cut through my wrist. Without thinking, I lifted my hand and grabbed the door handle. The soldiers shut my hand again, a child's left hand. I fainted and fell to the ground. It was more frightening than even death. Today, at this gathering of women, I appeal to justice and to your conscience. A war which women and children will suffer the most. That kind of war in this world must be prevented. Thank you.
That's an excerpt from Crossings, a documentary now streaming on PBS World Channel. Christine Ahn, I was wondering if you can respond to who she is, and also this Wall Street Journal op-ed, the phony Korean peace movement that personally attacks you and the peace movement, saying that the mobilization and the legislation promote the North's demand that the U.S. sign an unconditional peace agreement.
I haven't read that piece, but I'm aware of that trope. Absolutely, this is a legitimate peace movement. And it's not just a peace movement of peace activists across the country that are multi-generational Korean Americans. These are a lot of faith-based leaders like the United Methodist Church or the Presbyterian Church. These are Korean American leaders who have been involved in engaging with North Korea. They are the ones that actually made the call to President Carter to go on a plane armed with a CNN camera crew to go meet with Kim Il-sung because the Clinton administration was close to conducting a preemptive strike on North Korea. And so this is a well-established, long, multi-generational peace movement that has been calling for the U.S. to replace the ceasefire with a peace agreement. This extends across the border. Just this past weekend, masses of South Koreans under the Korea Peace Appeal, which includes over almost 500 civil society organizations, gathered on the streets. They protested. They sang songs. We are collectively calling for an end to this war that is threatening the future of 80 million Korean people. But all of us that are in this diaspora that is calling on our government, the Korean people in North and South, they can only deal with their governments. But we in the United States must pressure the United States to do the right thing. As we saw in the last summits between Trump and Kim and Kim and Moon, there was a moment where we felt that peace was actually going to break out. But unfortunately, the Trump administration, under John Bolton's leadership, basically did not follow through on some of the commitments that they made. And so here we are in a situation with the Biden administration that is basically a return to strategic patience, which is doing nothing. And that result is more provocation, more military exercises, the biggest, most dangerous ones on display between the U.S. and South Korea. North Korea, last year, I think they tested more than 200 missiles. And actually, there was a CSIS report, Lisa Collins, that actually, I mean, CSIS, but it actually showed that there was an inverse correlation, where the more military provocations that there are, the less likely there will be engagement. But when there is engagement, active diplomacy, there is very little provocation.
And I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the Korean diaspora here in the United States. Again, for those of folks who don't know the history, there was a significant development of the growth of the Korean communities in the United States starting in the 1970s, when Jimmy Carter first began reducing the U.S. troop deployments in South Korea. Could you talk about the direct relationship between the growth of the Korean diaspora and the continued U.S. Military presence in South Korea?
Well, absolutely. I think that it's also the growth of democracy in South Korea, right? South Korea didn't really fully become a democracy until 1998 with the election of Kim Dae-jung. So I would say that it's It's both. It's the growth and the political organizing of Korean diaspora. And now, you know, at this gathering, we've, you know, raised funds and 30 under 30 youth will be coming to participate. We see this like new energy with this